Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome back to the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, winner of the coveted Nice Try Award at several international film festivals. Got a really good show today. My guest is Joan Myers, and Joan has taken a fresh look at a story that I think we all were pretty much satisfied had been reported fairly accurately over the years. We're talking about the murder trials of Roscoe Arbuckle in 1921. He was accused of causing the death of an actress named Virginia Rappe, and we have pretty much always known that he did not cause her death. But in the course of clearing his name, history has gone the other way in almost blaming the victim and turning Virginia Rappe herself into a joke at best and a pariah at worst. The worst kind of character assassination has befallen this poor woman whose only crime, as far as I can see, is that she had the bad luck to show up at the same hotel where there was a party or an open house going on, and getting sick, getting peritonitis, and dying in agony over the course of 4 horrible days. Roscoe Arbuckle did not kill Virginia Rappe, at least as far as we know, but we almost forget that Arbuckle was not the victim here. He did have his career ruined, and certainly it did not work out well for him. It was a terrible thing. But Virginia Rappe is the one who died, and she's the one who died in terrible pain. And she certainly does not deserve what she's gotten from posterity. And so for the first time, a researcher has gone into all the court records, all the trial transcripts, coroner's reports, to show us that a lot of the preconceptions that we've had about this terrible day are really unfounded. And she did not set out to prove that Roscoe Arbuckle was in fact guilty. He was not. He did not deserve what he got. But neither did Virginia Rappe deserve what she got. And so we will talk about that, and I think you will find it fascinating. This is another time when I have to sheepishly admit that a ghost seems to have gotten into my sound machine. And the sound went wonky for some reason, and I actually spent about 4 times as long trying to equalize the sound as I did in doing the original interview, and it still goes a little kerflooey here and there. You might have to ride your volume control a little bit, and I hope it will not prove too distracting. I don't think it will, because I think the content of this interview is so engrossing, and the take on this event that is so famous, yet so misunderstood, is so interesting, and Joan tells it so well that I hope that you will forget that when it comes to being a sound engineer, I am an amateur at best. So I hope you will enjoy and learn something from today's episode, and we will see you on the other side. Here's my conversation with Joan Myers.
I know the exact date that I got into silent films. It was the centennial of Buster Keaton's birthday. They showed AMC, back when AMC actually showed real films.
I remember that.
They showed the whole day of Keaton films, and I had come down awful sick with a cold. I mean, deadly sick. So I crawled out of my bed and plopped myself down on the couch and turned on the television. Could not find my remote. You know, it was stuck on AMC. So I was coughing and sneezing and hacking and watching Buster, and within 20 minutes I was hooked. The first film was Go West, and I've always had a fondness for that film. The second he appears in that silly-looking devil suit, I just lose it. Just lose it.
Well, how long did it take you before you started looking into silent film and reading about it and so forth?
Almost immediately. Once I spent the whole day blowing my nose and watching Buster. And at that point, it was, no, I must know more. I must. I was living in Seattle at the time. There's a great video store there. I don't know if it's still open, but Scarecrow Video, one of the great video stores in the universe. So I went and systematically worked my way through every silent they had, and they had quite a few silents. This was back in the VHS days. The old days of VHS, when you could sit down on the couch and fire up the old VHS. I remember the strongest memory I have was I kept running into Valentino's films. You know, it was Four Horsemen, I think, on tape, and I kept pushing it aside, going, "Oh God, no! I'm not going to like that at all," because I'd seen the eye-popping photos,
sure,
like everybody else, and I just thought, "Oh, I'm just going to hate that."
Yeah, you have this idea of what it's going to be, yeah.
And then I finally, it was the last one, and I begrudgingly pulled it off the shelf. I guess I'll have to watch this. And I took it home and popped it into the old VHS, and he went into that tango, and I sat up on the couch and said, "Everything I know is wrong." Oh my God. So that was pretty much my beginning. But at that point, I still wasn't interacting with anybody else. I figured it was, oh my God, I'm all alone in the universe.
Yes, you were making your own mashed potato Valentino at that point. Huh?
Yeah. So then I moved back here to Los Angeles. Somehow I just sort of got involved with the group. I started doing work on Betty Bronson, and then...
And what was it about her that captured you? Because it's kind of hard to come up with stuff on Betty Bronson.
It was Peter Pan. It was such a charming film. It still is a charming film. But there, other than that, her career wasn't all that long, really.
And very little survives. At least very little that I've seen.
Silent film.
Yeah.
Essentially, when her career was over, she married and had a kid and kind of did that thing for a while. And then William Everson contacted her when she was an older lady, a cute little gray-haired grandma lady, and encouraged her to fire up the second half of her career as a character actress. And she did some pretty interesting things. I think the most interesting is that Sam Fuller film. Is it The Naked Kiss?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a bizarre film, but she's very good in it. Then it just grew from there, I guess. Somehow I was sucked into this community and can't get out of it. It's like quicksand.
And when was it that you discovered Nita Naldi? Because that must have been a day that you remember, too. Don't we all remember the day we were first introduced to Nita Naldi?
Actually, quite honestly, I think that was me just goofing on old AMS. That I, for some reason, picked a vamp. And...
I always had a feeling it was kind of a pulled out of the hat sort of thing.
Pulled out of the spike heel. We're going to talk about it, you know. And it just kind of grew from there. And essentially, it was just sort of me goofing around. It started, but then it, frankly, the Daughters of Naldi have grown into something I think a little different than that. As we sort of started pulling women together who had interests in silent film research, writing about silent film, studying silent film, a variety of different aspects. We would always get together if we were in town, we'd get together, have drinks together. And we sort of kind of one day looked around and said, well, wait a minute, why don't we kind of make this a real thing? We're all sort of sitting here. And so now we call ourselves a sorority. We're not an academic group. We're just a group of women who have an interest in silent and early film, do research in it, do work in it, and we enjoy being around each other. We help each other when we can. And so we're the Daughters of Naldi. And it all started with me goofing around on AMS. So
mighty oaks from tiny acorns grow.
I don't know if I'd call this an oak precisely, a willow, something a little more graceful.
Perhaps still a bunch of saplings, we'll say that. Like. Let's get over to the main subject of the day. Virginia Rappe, as everyone who knows anything about film history knows, here's the story. There's a party. This horrible slut, Virginia Rappe, who's a terrible actor.
Slutty McSlutter.
Slept her way into the few movie roles she ever got, which were few, and in which she was awful. And she comes to this party just to throw trouble, we guess.
Yeah. Crashes
the party.
With her evil...
Yes. Maud Delmont.
Maud Delmont.
Yes.
And I would like to stress that is evil.
Yes.
Not evil.
She's evil.
Yeah.
She goes into a room with Roscoe Arbuckle.
Uh-huh.
And then...
Deliberately
gets really, really sick.
Mm-hmm.
And Roscoe Arbuckle goes, oh, geez, she's sick, and leaves. And then she ruins the whole party. And then she dies.
She did that
then
so
Roscoe
much.
Arbuckle is unfairly accused of doing this to her and is put on trial for murder. So have I got the story pretty much right?
I think that pretty much covers it. There are some details we left out.
Yeah.
Synopsis.
Possibly, yeah.
That pretty much covers it.
Yes, I didn't even mention the Coke bottle.
Yeah.
No.
Or the wine bottle sometimes.
Ah.
It's, maybe there was both.
Well, Coke has brand authority, so,
yeah. Whatever, just not Pepsi.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that about covers it. I think if you Google it, that's pretty much what you'll find.
Yeah. So what made you start to think that maybe this was not the story that reflects what really happened?
My natural skepticism. Just, wait a minute. This is not working for moi. And plus, I didn't like the inherent misogynism of it. So I just, screw this. I'm going to start looking. And did. And fairly quickly, I think it was within a month, realized, again, like the Valentino thing, once you actually see the primary source, oh my goodness, everything I know is wrong. So I just kept going from there, kept gathering more material.
So how did you start researching it?
Well, the first thing I did was, obviously, the first thing, if you're going to talk about the Arbuckle trials, is you start looking for court materials, transcripts, you start looking for court documents. Some of that stuff is there, some of it is not. I got one transcript, the transcript for the preliminary hearing. That was, do you know what a preliminary hearing is? It's very helpful to understand.
Oh, of course I do, but tell my ignorant listeners what it is.
Well, one of the things that I've learned, and it has been very helpful, not just to me, but now to other people, is understanding what all these administrative procedures, what all these court procedures are, how court paperwork is generated, why it's generated, where it's stored. If you're going to go look for something, that stuff is all very easy to know. And it's not actually intrinsically obvious. Sometimes it can be rather Byzantine, especially with American courts, where there are so many different courts. I don't think you would have the same difficulty in a place like Britain, where the courts are, I think, probably all what we would call federal courts. But we have a lot of different courts, and knowing exactly what kind of hearing takes place in what court and where the paperwork is and what paperwork they would keep, what they would discard, that's very helpful. You don't spin yourself around. I was really fortunate in having a friend who works for the California Appeals Court, Criminal Appeals, here in Los Angeles. And she, when I get very frustrated, she would sort of explain things to me, kind of like I was an idiot. And she has been very helpful in locating paperwork for me and telling me where to go, where to find it. Now I know how to do that myself. You tell me something took place in a court and I have a pretty good idea where the paperwork is going to be, if there's any paperwork left. It's like the courts don't throw anything away. They just, when you're looking at something that took place 90 years ago, paperwork gets lost.
Sure.
And papers get misfiled. Papers get stolen. One of the problems they have in the Los Angeles court system is it's the reason that they stopped people from actually going into the archives themselves was that people were stealing things. especially when it comes to movie stars, anything like that. So, I will say one of my favorite moments in court paperwork was realizing, or at one point when I sort of started to think through it, and I thought, well, Virginia died intestate. I wonder if there's a probate file down there. So I wrote, you know, I sent a nice little check. Please, you know, here's the information that I'm looking for. And I got a nice letter back that said, nope, sorry, we can't find anything. And I handed it to my friend, my letter, and said, oh, well, they don't have anything. And she said, you're out of your mind. The next day she came back with the file.
Wow.
So I have the file with the letter that says we don't have it.
Nice.
I kept that. And that was my lesson. Do the work yourself.
Yeah.
Especially these days, as courts are so understaffed nowadays, they don't have time to go looking for something because it's
sure.
a dead old movie star. They don't care. They have real cases right now that they have to worry about. So,
well, what did you learn from that file?
From her probate file, where she lived while she was in Los Angeles, how much money she had. Right off the bat, can't think of what else I learned. But it was just one of those things where you get some facts from here, some facts from there, and you start weaving them all together. At least knowing where she lived, you know, for the entire 5 years that she was in Los Angeles. That was helpful.
Let's back up a little bit and learn a little bit about Virginia Rappe. Mm-hmm. I've seen her only in very little.
Well, that's because she did very little.
Very, yeah, and...
And that, she has a better survival rate than
yes. Yes. Yeah, there are more.
Or Betty Bronson.
Yes, more Virginia Rappe films than Theda Bara films. Was she an extra girl? Did she really have any parts speak of?
Well, she had two big parts, one, both with Fred Balshofer. The first one was Paradise Garden in 1917. She had a co-starring role in that with Harold Lockwood. And although, you know, he isn't one of those people that, you know, if you Google huge stars of the silent era, you should, because he was a big star.
Sure.
But because he died in 1918, and he doesn't have good availability, he's not that well remembered. I mean, you don't find a lot of actually scary Harold Lockwood groupies. Well, there may be a few out there.
And they would be scary, yeah, I would think, yeah.
They'd be kind of terrifying, but... So that was actually a big role, and she was well reviewed for it. It's the only film where she did get reviewed, frankly. Then the next year she did what the hell, that piece of crap. Am I allowed to say piece of crap?
You can say piece of crap.
Okay. An Adventurous Isle of Love, Over the Rhine, or is it Beyond the Rhine? I can't remember it. It was a film that she did with Julian Eltinge. Is it Eltinge or Eltinge?
I've always heard Eltinge.
Eltinge, but, okay. Well, we'll just go with Eltinge.
Maybe
if Miles Kruger hears this and
yes, we'll find out about it.
Oh, my God, will we hear about it. Eltinge was a big star.
He was a big star.
Not so much movies, stage, but he was as big as they come. So, in fact, those two films with Balshofer, those were big films. And then when she became involved with Henry Lehrman, which I think she had been there in Los Angeles probably for a couple of years before that. They may have met. I don't know when they met. But when she became involved with him, then she started doing short comedies with him. And as far as I know, there's only four or five of those. There are four that survive. There are a couple of things that they claim that she's in that she's not in. And there's one that's questionable. I've seen some of the films and I see no indications of comedic genius, but I'm the last person in the world to make that call because I don't have the slapstick gene. So
sure.
I don't see indications of Chaplin's comedic genius.
Well, there are probably several people who could argue that.
Who could elucidate that for me? And I'm willing to allow. As I say, your mileage may vary there.
Let's take a little bit of a sidebar. Since you mentioned Henry Lehrman, he is another person who I might wonder if history has given him a bum rap in a way, because as he was known colloquially as Henry Pathé Learman. Mm-hmm. And the way I've always heard it was that he had lied about working for Pathé. Mm-hmm. And that just became the joke that followed him, yeah, for the rest of his career.
But it wasn't a joke because he himself used it.
Ah.
You know, if you look at ads, you know, the ads that he has placed in various journals and things like that, he himself used the name Pathé.
Wow.
So he wasn't a stupid man. So, you know, he would have been able to tell if it was derisory. He used it himself. Now, interesting, that story comes from, I believe, from Linda Arvidsson's biography or autobiography. And she wrote that, what, 25 years after the events or something?
Something like that.
Yeah.
They're possibly not all that authentic in many ways.
many of those autobiographies, I find, are flawed in a variety of ways.
At the risk of overstating, I would say all of those autobiographies are seriously, yeah, flawed when it comes to hard facts.
And all of them are subjective.
Yeah.
At the best, they're subjective.
Probably ours would be were we to write our memoirs.
And I'm writing mine now, and they're about as subjective.
There you go.
They are openly subjective. This is my story.
Yes. I'll read yours first, and then I'll write the true story.
Yeah.
So.
Plus, a lot of them are ghostwritten.
Sure.
So, and there was a whole spate of them that came out in the 50s, 60s, maybe even up to the early 70s.
Oh, yeah.
Quite a bit of them, very self-serving, too. I'm my dad. Have you ever read Little Me?
I sure have.
Oh, dear God.
Oh, yeah.
That's the best one out there, isn't it?
Well, yeah. But almost all of them, from Frank Capra's on down, they're all self-serving, mm-hmm, and they're all slippery with the facts. Mm-hmm. And you read them for entertainment value, not necessarily for hard facts.
And that's the thing I think about show business autobiographies. This is a group of people who made their careers, made their lives entertaining people.
Sure.
And a lot of them came from vaudeville. I mean, those are the toughest audiences on the planet. And I think they could size an audience up within a second and a half and know exactly what they wanted and give the people what they want.
Sure.
That doesn't mean they're without value. But you wouldn't want to weave together a history of film just by sewing together autobiographies. That would be seriously...
Although people have.
People have. But, yeah, that would be a seriously disappointing...
I think we could name some of those books, too, but let's be charitable for the time being.
But back to Henry Learman, I have an interview that was done with him, I think it was in... maybe 1914, 1915, and somebody asked him, where did you get the nickname Pathé? And he said, well, you know, I'm not exactly sure where it popped up. D.W. Griffith liked to give people nicknames. And he nicknamed just about everybody, and he started calling me Pathé, probably because... He said I may have been speaking Polish. He said because he would have given where he came from, he would have spoken Polish. But he said probably because he may have thought I was speaking French. He said, which I also speak. So he said I think that's actually where it came from. So that's an entirely different take on it.
Sure it is.
You know, and that D.W. Griffith liked to give people nicknames, and there are people that do that. You know, Sparky.
Yeah. But I bring up the legend of Pathé Learman because it all ties in with she was such a pathetic, you know, she was the legendary joke. You know, did you ever hear about the blonde who was so stupid?
Yeah.
She came to Hollywood and screwed the writer.
Yeah.
Well, that Virginia Rappé had so little savvy, mm-hmm, that she got in with this.
Henry
Learman, the joke. Yeah. Well,
but
he wasn't a joke.
At
yeah.
that time. He may have been an unpleasant personality. Everybody has unpleasant.
A director? Come on.
Yeah. Like, you fool me.
Yeah.
But then again, occasionally there have been people that were very loyal to him. Norman Torok was very loyal to him. Jack White. people like that, the people that worked with him, were very loyal to him. When I spoke to Coy Watson Jr., who
said...
One of the wonderful Watson clan. It was interesting because I asked him... He'd worked with Lehrman when he was a little boy, when he was working in. And I just said, what did you think about Henry Lehrman? And he didn't hesitate a second. It was like that. He said he was a very sensitive man, and my father thought he was one of the best directors working in Hollywood. Okay, well, that's not standard.
Sure.
But he didn't have time to think about it. You know, it just popped out. He didn't have time to rehearse it or anything.
Yeah.
So just occasionally you get that kind of thing that sort of creates cognitive dissonance. There's, as far as I know, there's nobody around that still remembers any of these people. I certainly know with Virginia there isn't. And God knows I looked. I mean, I have tracked people down, and they are dead. So you're just sort of going on what you can find. But Lehrman, as I say, he may have been an extremely unpleasant personality, but he seems to have been very loyal to his friends. People also, for a long time, of course, because, well, he was a miserable human being, ergo he did bad comedy films, and I think, again, I'm hardly the person to ask, but I think the mafia are now sort of realizing, well, no, that's kind of not true. His comedy films are unique and interesting, and I still think they're about as funny as a gangrened leg, but that's just me.
That's just you.
Yeah. Yes.
But it is weird, though, that it's in order to make this case against Virginia, that in some ways,
well,
it's like everybody gets swept into it in some way.
Well, we have, you know, we've got our good guys, we've got our bad guys.
Yeah.
You know, and nobody ever just looked at it. To me, they weren't looking at it like just a lot of people who were caught up in a situation that was just awful for everybody involved. It was bad. It was horrible for Arbuckle. It was worse for Virginia Repe, because I am going to stand firm on the idea that dying a long, agonized death is far worse than losing a career.
Absolutely.
I'm firm on that.
And she died a particularly horrible death. When I've read what you've written about it, when I've read anything that talks about her last days, it's awful.
Yeah.
And, well, we should get to that, I mean, because people don't know what we're talking about. But she died in agony over the course of days.
Yeah.
And for reasons that continue to elude me, and maybe you've figured it out, but nobody seemed to do anything for her.
And well, they didn't have her.
Well, yeah, I guess.
No,
yeah.
This is 1921 we're talking about. And that's something, too. You cannot judge the way that she was treated then by the standards of today, where today of something like it, well, even today, I think they will sometimes let people who are in hideous pain go for a long time, sometimes for sound medical reasons, and sometimes just because an emergency room is overstocked, you know, with patients. So, but yeah, don't judge. You cannot judge the way she was treated by the standards of today. There is a huge difference there. But it's still, you know, when it boils down to, good God, don't let me die like that.
Yeah.
You know, and that is something that has never been dealt with before. I mean, frankly, because if you look at the way it's written, it's like, and then she created all this trouble at the party, and then she maliciously died just to destroy Arbuckle's career.
That bitch.
Yeah.
Like,
really?
Come on.
Carrying it a little far.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Jeez. So as we're assembling our cast of characters here, tell me a little bit about who Maud Delmont was.
She was, in fact, Virginia didn't know her. She just met her at for the trip up to, they originally went to Fresno. The idea was that they were going to go to Fresno to take care of something that Maude Delmont had to take care of. That is never stated, but it was probably court paperwork or business paperwork signing, something like that, because she was in the middle of her marriage was being annulled at that time. It was indeed a bigamous marriage, and I'm not quite sure when her husband figured that out, and I just sort of have fun imagining him sitting over the breakfast table and him saying, "Your divorce was final when?" Suddenly realizing, oops. So he filed for an annulment. I would suspect that probably meant that the marriage had gone south anyway, because they could have just waited and gotten remarried, but they didn't. But at any rate, she came back to Los Angeles. She was living in Fresno, and she came back to Los Angeles, but then had to go back up to Fresno for, it was unstated, but that's what I am assuming that it was. And she met Al Semnacher, who was someone that she had known, at least not well, but they were acquaintances. She met him coming out of the Pig and Whistle. And just chatting, she mentioned it. He himself was in the middle of a divorce, and he just said, "Well, I'll take you up. I'll bring my son up with you." And then the son, for whatever reason, and again, that was something that was never stated, couldn't go. So he said, "Well, I know this young actress, and maybe she'd like a day trip, and so we'll just go." I mean, it was just one of those things.
Yeah. That seems kind of arbitrary. I mean, was Maude Delmont involved in the movie business at all?
She was, for at least a short time. She imagined or thought she was an actress, and she may have been an actress. She was actually quite a pretty woman, but earlier on, and by that time, she was in fact a beautician. But she did know some people, so. I have never seen her in anything. I only have a couple of pictures of her, so I don't know if I would even recognize her if I did see her.
So she didn't even know Virginia Rappe before this?
She didn't know her. No, they met on the trip up. And then they went up to Fresno, and this was over Labor Day weekend, so it was a 3-day weekend. They went up to Fresno, they took care of their business, and Virginia herself said, "Look, we're this far, why don't we just go on to San Francisco and then go back from there?" So, and that's what they did. It interests me the times involved in getting from one place to another. It took them, according to the witness statements, they left Los Angeles at about maybe 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, and they got to Fresno around 8 or 9 that night, because they had to go over the old road.
Sure.
Over the grapevine. So that probably took them a heck of a lot of time. Once they hit the flatlands, once they hit the San Joaquin Valley, they probably just pedaled to the metal.
Yeah.
And zoomed up to 40 miles an hour. So, and those
old cars could go pretty fast.
Yeah.
They could go fast.
And then it took them, they left Fresno at about 1:30 in the afternoon, and it took them until 9 o'clock to get to, because again, they're going over to get to San Francisco. And plus, they had to go, they didn't have a bridge then, so they had to stop at the ferry and take the ferry over to San Francisco. So that just, wow.
So they're going to San Francisco and going to the party and all that stuff was just a series of...
It was a series of coincidences.
Yeah.
They checked into the Palace Hotel that night. They woke up the next morning and they were having breakfast, and Virginia got a phone call from Fred Fischbach, saying, "You're in town, come on up." And the reason that she got the call from Fred Fischbach is that there was a friend of Fischbach's at the party named Ira Fort Lewis, who was a salesman for Hixson's. Hixson's was a couturier, New York couturier. And he had spotted Virginia, and he recognized her. What he said was, "Well, I think she would make a good model, but Hixson's clothed Julian Eltinge." So he was one of the designers that Eltinge used, and I suspect that Fort Lewis may have known who she was, because she was in that film with Eltinge. Or he may have recognized her, not known who she was. "Oh, that's that, what's her name?"
And for people who don't know, El Tinge was a female impersonator.
He was a cross-dresser.
Yeah, that was his act.
It was...
And an incredibly successful act.
It was a very successful act, and there was a lot more going on to it. And I'm not an El Tinge historian, but there's all sorts of books out there. Read them.
Yes, we can't do everything for you. Look this stuff up. Yes.
God.
We don't have all the answers, folks.
I'm intellectually lazy.
Yes.
That's what I think. You know, I'm reading between the lines there. I mean, it was known that Fort Lewis did say that he told Fred Fishback that he had seen this Virginia Rappe person, and Fishback said, well, and Fishback and Arbuckle both said, well, we know her. Call her. See if she'll come over. You know, so they did, and she did. And, it was as simple as that. And there's nothing sinister about it, frankly. Only in your dreams is it sinister. It's just two ships passing in the night. Happens every day, everywhere. So there was nothing sinister about it.
There's this big party going on at...
Let's correct that right now. It really wasn't a big party going on. It was really more what you would call an open house. Arbuckle had arrived. Arbuckle and Fishback and Sherman had arrived the day before. You know, they'd come up to San Francisco to play. People do that. We do that these days. I go to San Francisco to play. You go to San Francisco to play. People go to San Francisco to play. There's nothing sinister in that either. So they just kind of...
And again, long weekend, Labor Day weekend.
Long Labor Day weekend.
So people go places to have fun.
They went to San Francisco to have fun, but he knew a lot of people there. He'd been there several times before. He was on stage there before, I think in vaudeville, because he played all up and down the West Coast. And show people know each other. Lowell Sherman was born in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. He knew people that were there. He knew Alice Blake. So, you know, they're out and about, and they're saying, you know, just stop by the St. Francis. We're at the St. Francis in the suite. Come on by. Just visit us. And so people were coming in. They were going out. They were having a drink or two. They were leaving. They were chatting. It was not an orgy by any means. Or if it was, it was the dullest orgy ever.
Well, it doesn't even sound like it was a party. I mean, the way it's always been depicted is that it was a big jazz age, popping champagne corks. No. People on people's shoulders.
You don't think that some of the other people in the St. Francis and the rooms next to them might have complained about that? Not to mention the St. Francis management itself, because it's a pretty staid hotel.
They were all in on it. They were all in on the conspiracy.
That was masterminded by the Dr. No of the Arbuckle case, Maude Delmont. That's it. They just stopped in. They were going to have a couple of drinks. That's all. And leave. Of course, that couple of drinks things is a little bit questionable at the beginning of Prohibition. And that's something we also tend to discount. Well, it was just a couple of drinks. It's a couple of drinks at the beginning of Prohibition. It was illegal. And there was one woman who would not stay in the room. A friend of Arbuckle's, a woman by the name of May Taub. He had arrangements to go driving with her, and she came up and saw the booze and said, no way, I'm not staying. And that's not being necessarily a Puritan. That's just saying, it's illegal and I could get into big trouble.
Sure, yes.
This is just not good. And although he didn't say so, Al Semnocker, too, was in and out of the room constantly. He would show up, and then he would leave again and be gone for a while, and then he would show up, and then he would leave again. And I suspect that because he was going through kind of an ugly divorce at that point, his wife had left him and left him with the three kids. He had three kids, and she just up and departed. And he had filed for divorce, and he was angling for custody of the kids. And I think his situation was such that he just kind of went, meh, this is the last place in the world I need to get caught at. So he was in and out the whole time. The alcohol should not be written off as a causative effect for a lot of the behavior because it was a big thing. It's fine. As long as nothing had happened, nobody really would have cared. But the minute something goes wrong, and it did go wrong, it's all of a sudden, oh, holy crap, we've got alcohol here.
Yeah.
We're all in deep. Yeah.
Nobody say anything.
Yeah.
Nobody.
Yeah. Let's just be quiet.
Yeah.
Make it go away.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and when you look at their behavior, you sort of realize, well, that's exactly what they were doing. It's kind of like behavior you would see at a frat party. If tradition holds true, I don't want to diss frat parties unnecessarily.
Yes. We have a vast fraternity audience listening here, so let's not offend any of them.
Yes, let's not offend the Omega Pies. So, and about timing is always difficult, too. Because, again, people weren't looking at their watches. So they could, when they were being hammered to give exact times, they couldn't. They would say, well, it was after so-and-so arrived. Well, maybe it was about this time. And sometimes you get cross, and sometimes people just didn't know. So, but it was probably at about 2:30 that Virginia had to go to the bathroom, and how detailed do you want this?
give it to us straight.
She went into, first she went into the bathroom in Sherman's room, and Maude Delmont was in that bathroom, and so she went out, crossed room 1220, which was the central room that was being used as a reception area, and went into the bathroom in 1219, which was the room that Arbuckle and Fred Fishback were sharing. And that is in itself interesting. Why did Lowell Sherman have the big room? Because 1220 is a big room. And Fishback and Arbuckle, who were big guys, Fishback especially, were sharing the small room.
You would think Arbuckle would get the...
You would think
just
would,
by his show business stature, not just, to mention his physical stature.
Just yes. Because of the fact that his name was actually on the registration.
Yeah.
And you would think that he would have gotten the big room, but he didn't.
Interesting. No.
Lowell Sherman had that room. And, well, now, and it might be because 1220 faces Union Square. And so there may have been
the loud room, yeah.
And it was,
so he lost the coin toss.
Well,
in fact,
it was summer, and it was a warm summer in San Francisco, which means it was probably, 60, maybe 65 degrees?
Yeah,
so they were roasting. And they had all the windows and transoms open.
Sure.
And there's no air conditioning. So it may have been simply because it was a very noisy room with the road noise coming up and Union Square and stuff like that. Who knows? But whatever, that's one of those mysteries that we will probably never solve. So anyway, at 2:30 she goes into the room, and at about a half an hour later, Arbuckle, who had this driving engagement, went into his own room, and he closed and locked the door behind him. He wanted to get dressed. He'd woken up late that morning. Again, not really sinister. They'd been out the night before, so he'd woken up late, and he was in his robe, bathrobe, and jammies. And he went in to dress, closed and locked the door. And this is where the problem arises, because about, time is not accurate. Anyways, from, say, 15 to minutes to maybe a half an hour, it's more like 20 minutes later, maybe at about 3:15, 3:20, 3:25, something like that. For reasons that have never been elucidated, Maude Delmont started knocking on the door, on the bedroom door. Why don't you just open up and, I just want to see Virginia open up. He opened up the door, he walked out, and he said, Virginia's sick. Virginia seems to be sick, something to that effect. And when they went in, she was rolling around on the bed, holding onto her abdomen, moaning. And then it sort of all devolved from there. Some pretty bizarre behavior I think, occurred then, where they were trying to get her to come back. She was sort of in and out of consciousness at that point, and they were trying to get her to, oh God, wake her up. You know, well, you're right there sort of saying, okay, what's wrong with you people? You know, why are you behaving like, why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you dumping her in a bath full of ice? And why is Fred Fishback picking her up by her ankles and shaking her? What's that all about? What it's all about is that there's booze in the room. And again, they don't want anybody to know about
it. Yeah.
But did they ever say what they thought was happening with her?
They kept saying, well, we thought she was just drunk.
Hmm.
And I do not believe that for 2 minutes.
No.
They knew damn well something was wrong. They didn't want to know because of the booze in the room. Because
she was in serious pain.
She was in serious pain.
And blacking out.
And she just went unconscious, actually.
Yeah.
Rather early. And they were trying to wake her up. And finally just decided it would be best if she had her own room. I think Maud Delmont said, well, what? Let's just get her own room. And so they got her a room that was down the hall and around the corner a bit, and took her down there. And
now this is where, you know, it's, is it the era, or is it just that I can't see what was happening? Why didn't they take her to the hospital right then? Why did they get her another room in the hotel and not...
Part of it is the era. It's not an era when people just rushed off to the hospital for every little thing. That's a large part of it. And part of it, too, is I think they just wanted to be rid of the embarrassing party guest. She wants a room? Good. Get her out of here.
It was also a time when you had still got a doctor to come to your room.
And they did.
And they did, yeah.
They did. Arbuckle did call a doctor. And he did go to the room, and he did look at Virginia. He did not examine her. What he did was he smelled her breath. You know, he took her temperature, and he smelled her breath, and he realized she'd been drinking, and he just said, she's drunk, and walked away. And again, that's the time. And I'm not sure that you wouldn't make the same call now if somebody was unconscious, and you thought that they had drunk too much. You might make the same call now.
Yeah, once she's unconscious and she's not writhing around in agony, mm-hmm. I mean, seems to be the tipping point.
Yeah.
But once she's unconscious, if you see her and you say, well, yeah, passed out.
She's just passed out. That's all. The behavior beforehand is kind of iffy and leads me to believe that they weren't all that convinced that she was just drunk, that they were scared.
Yeah.
But once you get her out of the room, that's fine. She's somebody else's.
Do you think they thought it might have been bad alcohol that was making her sick, and that would make even more trouble for them? Because that certainly happened a lot.
It happened a lot, but a little later on in Prohibition's history. And remember, everybody else had been drinking the same alcohol, too.
Mm.
So it was certainly in the doctor's minds. And it was in the coroner's minds when they did the coroner's office autopsy. That's one of the things they checked for, was wood alcohol. But, you know, everybody else had been, you know. And again, I would like to stress that nobody was stone drunk. You know, people weren't falling all over themselves.
Yeah.
You know, it was the equivalent of a cocktail party.
Yeah.
You know, where people had just had a couple of drinks. So, and nobody else was behaving like that. So, yeah, they just, you know, sort of shoved her down the hall, and then kind of, phew, that's over with. Let's go on with the party. So,
So how often did doctors check on her? What did it take? A couple of days for her to die? 2 or 3 days?
Four
days.
Yeah. It was Labor Day itself, which was the, let me see if I can get the dates right, the 5th, the Monday. So, yeah, she died on Friday, just about exactly, she died at 1:30 on Friday afternoon the 9th. They did have doctors were coming in to see her. The first doctor had been, they originally called the hotel doctor. Wasn't that charming? That was back in the days when hotels had their own doctors and their own detectives, which I think is just the coolest thing ever. They had a house dick. That was so cool.
Well, we've seen that in a million comedies, yeah.
And in film noir, too.
Sure.
Yeah. And Philip Marlowe. Remember, Philip Marlowe was always talking to the house dick.
Yeah.
So.
Didn't want any hanky panky in those hotel rooms,
no,
that's for sure.
They were very, very careful about the hanky panky in the hotel rooms.
Yeah. That's why no hanky panky ever went on.
No hanky panky ever took place in a hotel room.
No,
come
on.
Certainly not in the St. Francis. We love you, St. Francis, by the way. I've stayed at your fine establishment myself, and it's a lovely hotel. Just want to make sure you know.
Yes.
So, yes, there were, after the first doctor came and went away, the second doctor came up. By the second doctor, I mean the real house doctor. The house doctor was not there when they had called. And so they called a colleague of his who was at the St. Francis Hospital. That can get confusing because he was in the St. Francis Hotel, but he was also on staff at the St. Francis Hospital. So they called a colleague there, and he came over. When the house doctor came back, he went up to the room and visited her three times that night, and she was in horrendous pain, bad enough that he had to give her morphine. He couldn't even get near her. She wouldn't allow him to get near her to examine her. That's how bad the pain was. And he gave her morphine to get her calm. Recognized that there was something wrong, and with her bladder, too. He diagnosed something wrong with the bladder. And then just, he came back a second time that night. She was asleep, and then in the middle of the night, something like, I haven't got my notes in front of me, so times are a little hazy at this point, but I think it was about 4 o'clock in the morning when Maud Delmont called him again and said she was awake and the morphine had worn off and she was again in just horrible pain. And he came up again, catheterized her, didn't get any urine from the catheterization, and was very alarmed by it and said, you know, you need to take her to the hospital. She wasn't taken to the hospital. As to why that happened, why she wasn't taken to the hospital, I don't know. I can't say that the only person who had the right to make that decision was Virginia herself. And so maybe she decided not to go. Again, it's 1921, and people just didn't rush off to the hospital for every little thing. You know, they rushed off to die. So, who knows what that was? You know, what? But at some point, Maud Delmont decided that she didn't really like that doctor, and they did clash, because I've got the testimony, his testimony, and they did clash personality-wise. And so she decided to call in another doctor, and she called in a doctor, Melville Rumwell, who at that time was a Stanford physician, an associate professor at Stanford, and kind of an academic guy. He came in, looked at her. He seems to have misdiagnosed her. Again, she was having horrible abdominal pains, but he just, again, he assumed, oh, well, it's bad alcohol. She's just...
Wow.
Yeah. I don't get that. I don't understand it. But then again, I don't know what the symptoms of bad alcohol are either. So, and I think that was probably just a convenient catch-all diagnosis at that time, because people were starting to... die in record numbers from poisonous substances, and maybe that's just what he thought. I don't know if it's a reasonable diagnosis or what. But whatever, you know, it just went on and went on until Wednesday night. She started displaying symptoms of peritonitis, and I don't know if you've ever looked at what the symptoms of peritonitis are, but that's an extra added layer of fun on top of the ruptured organ. Mm. By Thursday morning, it was really advanced, and that was, you know, in a pre-antibiotic society, it's a death sentence. And at that point, he insisted that she had to be taken to the hospital. And so she was taken at about noon to Wakefield Hospital, which is... It was a small private... That's another part of the legend. Oh, she was squirreled off to a maternity hospital where they performed an abortion, and she died.
Hmm.
Well, it wasn't a maternity hospital. It was a hospital with maternity facilities, which in 1921 was kind of a big thing because 30% of babies were born in hospitals. Babies were still mostly born at home.
Sure.
But this was a hospital because Dr. Wakefield was kind of the big go-to guy in San Francisco for high-risk births. They had a maternity section there. But that's not why she was taken there. She was taken there because it's only half a mile away from St. Francis. And late that night, Dr. Rummel finally, you know, he's obviously realizing my diagnosis was way wrong. And he started calling people in, associates in, to look at her. Lockie High said that was called consultant's disease. When he said that happens when the doctor realizes that something's wrong and he starts calling everybody he can find to find out what, you know, to sort of save the patient's life because he doesn't know what's wrong. And he said suddenly the patient's chart gets very fat, so start generating records. The doctors at that point just said, there's not a damn thing we can do. If we try operating on her, she will die on the table. We're just going to have to hope and pray that it turns around. And it didn't. She died the next day, around 1:30. So, yeah, it's like, boy, do I hope I don't die that way.
Wow.
So...
When did it happen? And first, I just got to start thinking about poor Maud Delmont. What a crock she ended up in for really just, hey, let's go off for the weekend.
Let's go for the weekend.
Then she gets pulled into this hole.
Your weekend trip, Maud.
Yes. And A, that she gets not only pulled into this whole horrible experience, but then gets tarred with the brush that she had somehow been the engineer of it all, or had been of course, as you said earlier, she's evil.
Because she was evil.
Yeah. When did the blame start to be cast upon Arbuckle that he had done something to her?
Delmont, when Virginia was first moved out of the party suite, let's call it, when the doctors came, they asked her, well, what happened? Was there an accident of any kind? And for reasons that I'm not really sure of, they kept asking, did Arbuckle do anything to her? And I think that has always interested me. I think there may be some social thing there that I'm not catching. But they also knew, I mean, when she explained what had happened, I mean, it was glaringly obvious that whatever it was that had happened when two people were behind closed and locked doors. And before everybody starts clutching their pearls, that still doesn't mean that Arbuckle did anything to her. It just means they were behind closed and locked doors. But it's one of the things that they asked about. And at first, Delmont was saying, well, I don't think so. She wasn't there. She didn't see it. So she was saying, I think she was just drunk. But then, of course, she's stuck in a room for 4 days with somebody who is in agony. And who, have you ever tried to nurse anybody who's in a situation like that and was crammed full of morphine? It's not fun. It's not a load of fun.
Well, it sounds like fun.
No, it's just, hey, boy, I can think of nothing better to spend my vacation on. By the end of it, by the night before Virginia died, when the doctors were looking at her, she was stating that Arbuckle had attacked her, had attacked Virginia. I don't know why she made that leap, unless, you know, people, all I can think of is that maybe Virginia might have said something under morphine can cause you to hallucinate quite wildly. It's a miserable stuff.
Sure.
Morphine is. But one of the things it does do is make you hallucinate. And you don't know what, maybe Virginia had babbled something that led Delmont to believe this.
Is it possible that Arbuckle did do something to her?
Well, anything's possible. But, you know, Arbuckle wasn't that kind of guy. You know, it's just not, he didn't go around attacking people. He's not showing up in the news all that often, that kind of thing. But
that whole period is weird, though, because she's in his bathroom, and then he goes in and locks the door. So when you try to concoct a scenario of what was happening in there, it's possible that she was just in the bathroom and he kept saying, okay in there? I'm changing my clothes. Is everything going okay?
Yeah.
Or it could be that if she came out of the bathroom, that he said, hey, well, as long as you're here.
Whoop, let's play.
But even if she had just said that, that he had made an advance or something like that, I don't know. It's or maybe she's just hallucinating. We'll never know.
We will never know. We do know, we do have his testimony. We do know what he said happened. It's my belief that he probably stuck as close to the truth as he probably could, because it's not a whole hell of a lot of fun to have an attorney coming at you when you're in the stand. And the easiest way to get by on that is to stick to the truth as closely as you can. I don't think he necessarily told the whole truth. I think some things may have been changed, but I think he probably stuck as closely to the truth as he could. I think... Again, personally, my personal belief is that if he did anything to her at all, it was accidental. We don't have any record of him just running around attacking women.
And as much as I've ever read about him, nobody ever spoke of him except in the highest terms, in terms of his character. He was a beloved man.
Yeah. People liked him.
Yeah.
So, if anything happened, I'm pretty sure it was probably an accident. The only thing that sometimes causes me to draw back is that he was also known as a practical joker. Some of those jokes were not all that funny. Practical jokes often aren't all that funny.
Sure.
And, you know,
and those guys were hardcore too. They really were.
They elaborately and sometimes very mean practical jokes.
Yeah.
And that is the only thing. Oh dear God! What if he just thought he'd play some stupid trick and it went desperately wrong? Certainly not something he admitted to, but I suppose it is possible. Whatever it is, whatever happened, we will never know. Again, because the doors were locked. And both those people are long dead. So it's just useless to speculate at this point. We don't know. We will never know.
So what killed her was peritonitis?
Peritonitis, yeah. Eventually the ruptured bladder would have killed her if the peritonitis hadn't set in. But... we have to assume that at some point they may have said, let's go do an exploratory. Because if they'd caught it immediately before the peritonitis set in, there was a very good chance that they would have saved her life. And I will say, in the doctor's defense, is that ruptured bladders are extremely rare. It's a very freakish thing to have had happen. They are one of the rarest occurrences ever. Nowadays, they mainly occur because of automobile accidents, you get it's called
the slice, yeah.
Yeah, you get an acceleration or deceleration injury. You get thrown into a lap belt, and if you happen to have a full bladder, it accelerates urine with great force up through the bladder, and it then seeks the weakest point in the bladder, which happens to be the dome, the top of the bladder, and just bursts it. But that has to be an enormous amount of force.
So, of course, that's
and the... And that is where her bladder ruptured, too.
That's the stick that they've always beat our buckle with, though, is they've always said, well, this huge, heavy guy, he gets on top of her, and this is what happens. I don't know that medically that would actually bear out, but that was always...
I've made some extensive searches of the medical literature, and that one is not there.
but that was, I think, what people always inferred from his... If they started thinking that he had done something to her, then that's...
Well, and then, of course, there's the whole raping her with the bottle.
Well, sure.
Story. You know, that he raped her with the bottle. And I've heard that quite a bit. You know, and that's just...
Have you ever tracked it down to its source?
Oh, yes.
Oh.
You mean where that is... this is not very pleasant. when... After he opened the door and people were running back and forth, you know, doing stuff, you know, and sort of essentially running around like chickens with their heads cut off. She was in the bedroom. She was unconscious. Maud Delmont had gotten ice and was rubbing her wrists and her forehead. And why is that supposed to help when you're unconscious? People do it. I'm not sure why, but they do. And Alice Blake and Zay Provost were there. The two dancers were there. And Arbuckle walked back into the room, and he picked up a piece of ice and he stuck it in Virginia's vagina. And he said something, that'll make her wake up. And needless to say, that didn't sit very well with Maud Delmont or with Zay Provost or Alice Blake.
I can imagine.
And
did he really think that it was just going to shock her to consciousness, or?
I guess
that just seemed like such a stupid thing to do.
It was a very stupid thing to do.
Yeah.
It was a very stupid thing to do.
So that morphs into a bottle
through
the telling?
Because it came out in court. It actually came out very early. It came out very early on. When the police were questioning witnesses, they knew about that before Arbuckle even made it back to San Francisco. But they were trying to keep it quiet. But when it came out in court, of course, the reporters went gaga. But they wouldn't state because of, you know, the way they had to be sort of mealy mouthed back then. They wouldn't state exactly what it was. They just danced around it, and that dancing around is what led to the story of him raping her with the Coke bottle or with ice.
Yeah.
Or, you know, whatever. If they'd just come out and said what it was, you know. But that's where the story grew from. So
and I guess to sum up, your objection to this story was never that you thought Arbuckle had done something that caused her death,
no.
But just that you thought that she had been given a bum rap in the way that she had been presented as being culpable in her own demise in some way.
Yeah, it's not like that is really unusual, is it?
Not.
Well, you know, yes. You were walking down that street in broad daylight wearing that suggestive nun's costume? You must have been asking for it.
We don't have time to go through all the trials. There were three trials, right?
Three, yes.
And there were the jury was deadlocked twice.
Right.
But the third one is really interesting to me, and I think it's interesting to you as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's when we
have the least information.
Because that's when we get the letter of apology from the jury. So tell me about this.
No, the jury didn't write that letter.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's
they couldn't have written that letter. They didn't have time to write that letter.
But I've read everywhere that the jury wrote him a letter of apology.
And if they did, they were crooked.
Give me the ending of that trial. So
the ending of that trial, well, for one thing, it was a week longer than the other trials, and isn't that sort of interesting that a criminal trial would go on for a whopping 3 weeks, a high-profile criminal trial? And that's another big difference between then and now. I mean, nowadays, how long does it take something to get to trial? And especially these big criminal trials. What is it? The Simpson trial went on for a year?
Mm-hmm.
In Arbuckle's case, in 8-9 months, there was a coroner's inquest, a grand jury hearing, a preliminary hearing, and three trials within 8 months.
Wow.
So there are big differences in the way that the criminal justice system operated then and between the way it operates now. To me, I find that fascinating, and it's also the hardest thing for me because I'm not an attorney, or even most attorneys don't understand it. You need a legal historian who specializes in criminal justice to really put their finger on anything. Let's see. Closing arguments for trial three. The jury judge gives them instructions. Jury retires into the jury room. Have you ever been a juror?
I have, yes.
Yeah. So you kind of know how it works. They retire into that little room. And
we got bagels.
I'm
yeah. There you go.
I hate these
That's the
court reductions. I didn't get any bagels. But whatever. Jury retires 2.5 minutes later, and that is reported by all of the reporters.
Mm-hmm.
There are 2.5 minutes later, they knock on the door, indicating that they have a verdict. It then took additional minutes because some of the attorneys had left the courtroom and they had to be called back in.
Nobody expected it to.
Nobody expected no. that. They didn't expect it to come back that early. And the jury comes out. They read, the not guilty verdict, pandemonium in the courtroom. And then they went back into the jury room and they all signed that letter. Well, no, they could not have written that letter in that 2.5 minutes. I'm sorry. They could not have walked into that room, taken a standing vote, and then drafted and written a 4-paragraph letter that they all signed in 2.5 minutes. No. And they couldn't have written it beforehand because they were sequestered and they were not supposed to be talking about the case with each other. They couldn't have. Again, if they did write it beforehand, they were crooked. Let's not go there. The most likely explanation for that is that it was written by either an attorney or I'm going with Lou Anger because it doesn't read, it's not an attorney thing. What? A letter? We don't need that. But it's definitely a Lou Anger thing. It's a showbiz thing. I would suspect that it was...
And who was Lou Anger?
Lou Anger was Arbuckle's manager. He was Joe Skank's right-hand man for many, many years until his death. He was with Joe Skank. Joe Skank was, for the most part, on the East Coast during the entire trial, although he did go back and forth, but it was Lou Anger who was there all the time, and he was attached to Arbuckle like a burr from second one. He was there the whole time. And to me, when I look at that letter, I think that is a Lou Anger thing. that is, and it appeared in an ad for one of Arbuckle's films within a couple of days, the text of the letter.
Hmm.
Ooh.
That's just a coincidence,
well,
though, right?
A coincidence, yeah. Yeah. I think that it was probably written to offset the statement that was made by the coroner's jury, because they made an unusual statement, too, about, you know, we do not want San Francisco to become the home of the debauchee and the gangster. That was a very strange statement for them,
sure,
to have made, too. And I think that this letter was written to offset that. And I think it was probably written during the first trial, when they expected Arbuckle to be acquitted during the first trial, and it wasn't. The case hung. So that does not lessen the fact that the jurors did sign it. They did sign it, and they obviously, unless they were crooked, they did agree with it. They did agree with the sentiments, but they,
yeah,
did not write it.
And the sentiments were correct.
Yeah.
I mean, he was railroaded in this thing. And
yeah, given the situation, I don't know that I wouldn't have gone to trial if I was a DA. I don't think I would have pushed it as hard as the DA did. I think I would have said, first trial, okay, we lost it. Let's just cut our losses and let him go. It's really hard for a DA to say that, especially,
sure,
in a high-profile case like this, when people are screaming. You know, we've got one group of people screaming for blood. It is nevertheless a DA's job to do that. But, you know, you have to say they presented it to... Well, they didn't present it. The ball started rolling when Virginia died. They did an autopsy and found the ruptured bladder. And essentially, you know, what Dr. Rumwell said was, you know, I was still at that point of the opinion that it had been natural causes that caused her death. It was, you know, essentially when we found the ruptured bladder that they stood back from the autopsy table and said something really technical and medical, like, holy shit, call a coroner. It was the coroner that set the ball rolling, because when the coroner got involved, he's the one that he ordered an inquest. He ordered subpoenas to everybody and their dog, everybody that had been at the party, you name it, anybody that he could find. The second that the coroner's office is involved in something, the police are involved, because they work closely with the coroner's office. The second that the police are involved, they've got the district attorney on the horn, because, you know, we're gathering evidence and it's up to the district attorney to say, now's the point when we can arrest. Now's the point when we can take it to trial. We have enough evidence. So there's all these disparate groups that are working together, but it was the coroner that started the ball rolling. Given that situation, given the fact that half of San Francisco was reacting before Arbuckle even knew that Virginia was dead, I don't think there's any way that it would not have gone to trial, given the circumstances. And frankly, his career was over from the second that it hit the news.
Yeah.
And that was the next morning. Because they were just going to play it up.
And to the general public, he was always guilty. He was always guilty.
Well, no, you know, not from what I've... From letters and things like that to the editors, I think, you know, I think it was probably a half and half thing. And that probably half the people out there just thought he was guilty. And then there was a large percentage of people who may have said, well, I don't know whether he was guilty or not, but he was drinking. You know, and the attitude at the beginning of Prohibition was very different than what we think it was. They weren't all flappers drinking,
sure,
bootleg gin. A lot of people were very serious about Prohibition, about drinking being evil.
You're sure? We do.
I could go on like this for a long time.
Well, so could I. But we should give you a break and call a halt to it. And I think you've done remarkable research on this thing. I just am so impressed with all that you've come up with, because it's such a needed take on this story. And everybody has always gone on the same route, and they've all the other books seem to have avoided all this.
That it wouldn't have happened if that darn Maud Delmont hadn't been there.
For what it's worth, you've done a great service to her, because that's
she's
gotten a bad rep for a long, 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 long time.
I mean, she has, and you know, I think the thing that surprised me too was the fact that, you know, I said, "Well, I'm going to research Virginia Rappe," and then I went, "Holy, how am I going to find anything on Virginia Rappe, for God's sake?" You know, and was most surprised when I started finding information on Virginia Rappe. She was not Mary Pickford. She didn't have reporters following in her wake her entire life. But she also, she wasn't your traditional person or woman for back then. She was ambitious. She was intelligent. She was a hard worker. Entrepreneurial, very bright, kind of adventurous. I don't think that a lot of young women today would take the path that she did. Of course, she was an orphan, so she didn't, you know, it was do it or croak. But She was an interesting girl, I think, and I've said this before. I think that if things had been different, and if she had lived, that eventually she probably would have gotten married, and she'd be the kind of kick-ass grandma that you just love to show pictures of. And my grandma did this, you know, and you would be just desperately proud of her, because your grandma was cool.
Well, I guess on the bright side too. She never endured any of this character assassination. That
she was dead.
Yeah,
never bothered her.
Her life was perfectly happy. I mean, she's—it's her, or not perfectly. She was. She lived a. She had. It was perfectly interesting life. But but all of this stuff was.
You know, she didn't.
No,
she was dead by the time all this happened. But
But poor Henry Lehrman had to put up with a whole lot of stuff.
I think that a lot of that stuff arose after his death too.
Hmm.
A lot of this story stems from Minta Durfee. A lot of its weirder aspects.
And she was Roscoe Arbuckle's widow.
First wife.
Yeah.
No, she was not his
widow. Not his widow.
Yes, Addie MacPhail was his widow. A lot of it stems from Minta. And before people get the idea that I think Minta is the princess of darkness, I think that Minta's attachment to Arbuckle was very real. Although she had a very peculiar kick in her gallop and was the dark mistress of passive-aggressive. But also, with Minta, you know, her own career was over, essentially by the time Arbuckle left her in 1917, I believe. When he left, her career was over at that point. She continued to do some work here and there, but she may never have been really particularly interested in it, although I don't really know. But she's another one of these people who, you know, spent her formative years trotting the boards, and she was really good at picking up on what people wanted to hear.
Mm.
And face it, loyal wife was the best role she ever had. And she kept playing it. She kept playing it. So 50 years after the fact, after all of the facts are, you know, everything's gone, Arbuckle's dead, Virginia's dead, most of the people are dead who were involved in it. And she's still there. And people are, when you want to find out about the Arbuckle case, she's the first person you would go to, obviously.
Sure.
And she kept playing the same role and making it better. Let's just improve that.
A good story needs some enhancement now and again.
Yes,
so.
Now and again. And when you have a long time to enhance, it can get pretty distorted.
Sure.
So I think a lot of it, I think for the most part, people just kind of forgot about it. Oh, it was one of those scandals, you know.
Yeah. Well, you've done an enormous amount to straighten the truth out. And there are things which we'll never know, but mm-hmm. thanks to you, we know a lot more than we did.
Thank you.
So, thank you. Thanks very much.
There's a lot more I could know, too.
Well, you still got time. We'll do this again in a while, and you'll know even more.
Oh, God, I hope so.
Thanks, Joan. I really appreciate
it. You're welcome, Frank. I very much enjoyed it.
Bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Joan Myers, and hope that you see Virginia Rappe in a new light than perhaps you did before it started. I know that I've learned a whole lot about this case, not only from this interview, but from reading things that Joan has written over the last few years. And I've just been so impressed with her research on this and can't wait to see where it goes next. In fact, there's all sorts of really cool stuff that she wasn't really quite willing to go public with yet, because it'll go into her book, and there are more revelations to come. So I want to thank Joan again for this. She tells me that she thinks I'm going to get angry responses from people about this, and so if I do, here's how you do it. You go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, you hit the Contact Us, or maybe it says Contact Me, I can't recall, button, and then you can just send me an email and tell me what you think. And try to keep it civil. Let's, you know, we live in a harsh world, but there's no reason we can't be kind to one another. So if you have something to say on it, I'll be happy to read it. While you're at thecommentarytrack.com, before you write to me your angry letter, I hope you will look through the book and video links, order some books that I have written, and I will autograph them for you. Or order some videos that I've had something to do with, and use the Amazon links, and Amazon will give me a little bit of a kickback, and believe me, it's very little. So the more you do that, the more I will love you for it. I want to thank my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough, sometimes known as Claire Thompson. It goes either way, but she's my announcer, and more important, my dear wife. Want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my wonderful theme music, In and Out. And James Hutchins, who designed not only the website for thecommentarytrack.com, but also my personal website, frankthompson.tv. If you go to either one of those sites, in addition to ordering my books and videos, which I hope you will do by the dozen, you could also buy a poster for my upcoming documentary, The Lost Remake of Beau Geste. It's a 12x17 poster. I will be happy to autograph that for you if you like. It's, as they used to say in the comic book ads, suitable for framing. So I hope that you will consider that. It's only $10, and that's postage included. I can't even believe such... It's a laughable price. I'm laughing now, laughing on the inside. And I hope you will be laughing with joy when you frame that wonderful poster designed by Nick Newton, poster designer extraordinaire. And hope you will order a bunch and like them all and give them to all your friends. You know, Christmas is coming up. Speaking of Christmas, there are many books of mine on the website that you can order. But right now, I always like to point towards The Great Christmas Movies, which is a book that I wrote in conjunction with a special I did for American Movie Classics back in the days when they actually showed movies. And I wrote and directed this special called The Great Christmas Movies. I wrote this tie-in book, which is amply illustrated. It's got lots of chapters on all your favorite films. There's not a chapter on Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, because I had just written an entire book on that subject and felt like I didn't want to chew my cabbage twice. You can still find that book, Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas. You can always find that on eBay or Amazon.com. And if you order it from Amazon, remember, go through my website, click on the Amazon link, and order it there. Because it's the least I can do. I mean, at least I can get a little bit back from my own book, can't I? Come on. So I hope you will consider getting all those. Order the great Christmas movies, and you'll get it in plenty of time to give away as a Christmas present, or just to help you plan your Christmas movie viewing over the holidays. It's coming up. It's almost Thanksgiving now. Then after Thanksgiving, oh, it's only weeks till Christmas Day. So don't be left standing red-faced under the tree with no movies to watch and no idea what to see. Order my book and you'll know all about Christmas movies. I think I've done enough shilling for one episode. Hope you will join me next week when I have another great guest on the commentary track. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.